everyone. This episode covers the topic of sexual assault and also harassment, and also the justice system not doing what it was meant to do. So if this triggers anything for you, please give this a miss. And there are some resources in the show notes.
A listener production.
This podcast is being recorded on Gadigal land. We pay our respects to the traditional custodians of this country and elders past, present. We extend our respect to any First Nations, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us today.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Hey everyone. Okay, super excited for this episode. I cannot wait to talk to this beautiful human. She was Australian of the Year, which is such a slay, in 2021. And we spoke about her before on the podcast in many different ways. We've got the amazing Grace Tame. Hello.
Hi,
Gorge. So before we started recording, we're having a chat about your iconic photo with ScoMo, your moment with ScoMo, where you would not smile. And we were speaking about something really interesting. You brought up a very interesting conversation that I'd love to carry on here. And that is that every time you speak about that moment, it becomes the clickbait or the headline of anything you've spoken about, and everything else kind of falls to the wayside.
Yeah. So that was a really brief moment. I think the entire actual period of time was maybe 30 seconds, if that. And it has become this inflated, regurgitated thing that is now, you know, it's inflated out of proportion to its relevance. I think obviously it was something that resonated with a significant number of people, and I think that that's fantastic. But when you look at it in the context of the rest of the work that I've done and how little coverage that has received, that's the disappointing part. And so, you know, I'll go on podcasts and I won't bring it up, but the interviewer will bring it up, and we might cover a whole spectrum of conversation topics, and between the two of us might make 50 salient points, and none of those will get picked up. It'll just be the commentary about that photo, which reinforces the media's narrative or a certain cohort's narrative that I don't have any relevance if it wasn't for Scott Morrison.
Or that you're like a woman with vendetta, like you have a vengeance against.
As if I was the only person
who didn't like Scott Morrison at a moment. So you were the only person to speak up about it. I was doing ranting podcasts about it. Everyone hated him in that moment, and also it was someone to hate from Scott Morrison's supporters. It was a face to dislike and to hold on to. And the thing is, they're the ones that are actually holding on to the grudge, not you.
Yes, and the media runs on an adversarial binary that's very exaggerated. That's how they sell papers. You know, sensationalism has far surpassed education in terms of the purpose, the goal. Yeah, it's an interesting thing to reflect on. You know, and there's a reason as well that the media, in the early days of my being Australian of the Year and continuing to this day, were banned from attending my talks and therefore witnessing a majority of my activism and advocacy for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. I know you've got a nightmare fuel section, so I won't tell you one of the worst questions that I have ever had on stage.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, but I have had some curly questions, and I might be in front of 500, 1,000, 2,000 people. And anything can happen. And if that gets printed, then...
then that's the headline of the show. How do you feel about that moment with ScoMo now, then? Do you wish that it... not that it hadn't happened, but do you wish that it hadn't been picked up so much? Or are you glad that it did, because it kind of allowed a flow and effect for your other advocacy work, maybe to someone that wouldn't have known about you?
I feel a certain level of neutrality about it, I think, you know, because there's always the what ifs. I don't like to entertain those too much. I mean, my life has been pretty pendulous.
Yes.
9 months before I was named Australian of the Year, I was working a minimum wage job in another country. You know, I'd only ever worked hospitality and retail.
Yeah.
And then, moved back to Australia because COVID hit. I was an unemployed advocate. I was living with my aunt in a housing commission area right before that. You know, Max and I were sleeping on a mattress on the floor the night that I was named Australian of the Year.
Really?
And we went back to sleeping on a mattress on the floor. Mainly because we had to get rid of his squeaky bed frame because his roommate didn't like it,
what I mean. Is anyone listening? Got a big little wink from Grace Tame there. So your life changed overnight, really?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You wake up on that mattress on the floor and you went, new day. Time
well,
to go to IKEA.
I didn't wake up in a mattress on the floor. I woke up in the Crown Plaza where all the nominees for the different categories had been put up by the National Australia Day Council. Mm-hmm. But that was certainly, yeah, I mean, it was at once both the most private and the most public of moments. A matter of hours before, it would have probably been about 2 hours before I was in Parliament House on the 26th of January, so the day after, and did a round of media that went from 6 a.m. to 12 p.m. without stopping. I think I had at most 5 minutes yes. between interviews with all of the major morning shows and radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 hours before that, I was sitting in the hotel room that we had and I was reading a letter from my cousin. It was a really heavy letter and it was about what had happened when I was 15. I don't know how you translate what that experience is like.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to sit in front of these bright lights and you're in people's living rooms all across the country. You have to contain all of that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And also be the face and the spokesperson of something that is so important. There must have been a lot of pressure on you as well.
Yeah, I think the way that I frame it personally is to think of myself as an advocate of the community and not for the community.
Right.
I'm just one of many voices who can speak to this experience of child sexual abuse, which is, at the end of the day, it's a ubiquitous thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 1 in 5 boys and 1 in 3 girls on average that is abused before age 18. And that's probably underreported for a number of factors,
mm-hmm.
like the shame and stigma that are still such big challenges mm-hmm. for the community. And also when you think about 80%, if not more, of all child sexual abuse cases are incest. So of course it's jarring. Of course it's really complex. And it's mm-hmm. not as simple as just saying, oh, share your story, because a lot of people can be implicated and people who speak up against intrafamilial perpetrators as well mm-hmm. stand to not just lose their social connections, but also, you know, their economic foundations, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really complicated thing.
Yeah. So how do you, because you speak very publicly about a lot of things in your life. I'm sure there's a lot that we don't know about. I can imagine it's exhausting, particularly as someone who's neurodivergent, speaking about your personal experiences constantly, having articles written about them, and then having to continue to speak about them to the end of time without much control over what the questions you're getting asked are. How do you deal with that, being someone who is autistic, who has also experienced such large amounts of trauma and publicly spoken about it? It's a layer upon a layer of exhaustion.
Yeah, it is. There's multi-directional pressure, which I'm sure you can relate to as well. So it's not something that can be answered really simply.
Mm.
You know, I haven't had a lot of time to actually sit back and process all of the different events in my life. You know, if you consider something like prolonged child sexual abuse as well, and multiple incidents of child sexual abuse, which occurs at a point in your life when you're dopamine circuitry, you know, your reward circuitry, your entire brain is still forming.
Mm-hmm.
And grooming itself is a perverted system of punishment and reward mm-hmm. that conditions you to behave in a certain way, wherein your happiness gets tied in with the happiness of a perpetrator.
Mm.
To undo that is really difficult at the biological level.
Mm-hmm. Because when your brain is developing, it's getting these pathways ingrained.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's why you see a lot of people who have been mistreated in childhood
mm-hmm.
in whatever way, shape or form will unconsciously seek out maladaptive coping mechanisms, because what they're trying to do is reset that
mm-hmm.
balance
mm-hmm.
or actually establish a balance at all.
Mm-hmm.
There might not have been any equilibrium because, as we said, you know, there's that development that's going on at that time, neurologically, physically, socially. So a lot of people fall into the trap, especially in a society in which things like alcohol are so ubiquitous mm-hmm. and promoted, with all of these different narratives, like, you know, we associate alcohol with celebration, we associate alcohol with commiseration, we associate mm-hmm. alcohol with sophistication, we associate it with all these different things, isolation. And even if those things contend with each other, those narratives sometimes clash. You know, when we have that around us, it's really easy to fall into, as I said, maladaptive coping mechanisms
mm-hmm.
because they are so readily available.
Is that something you've struggled with?
Oh, certainly at different times in my life, I have struggled with And I've spoken about this openly. I spoke about this when I addressed the National Press Club on the 3rd of March, 2021. See, there's my autistic brain just going like, Rain Man,
I love
what's
it.
The number? This number.
I'm also good with dates, what was though, the weather? As well. ADHD, Chook. I'm like a dates person and like a phone number remembering person.
Yeah, I'm like that. Numbers.
Numbers, yeah. Numbers. Love them.
But yeah, I mean, anyway. I spoke about that pretty openly. I didn't go into much detail. It's layered. You know, they all intersect. They're all confused with each other. I did write about this in early 2022 when there was a photo circulated of me with a 2-foot bong.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes,
I did write about the harm that can potentially cause child sexual abuse survivors who've also had substances introduced to them in the context of the offending by the perpetrators, so that, you know, afterwards, well, also, you know, it encourages that feeling of secrecy and shame at the time. But then afterwards, children especially fear that they will be chastised for those behaviours.
For the maladaptive behaviours.
Yes.
In the
and
future
as
well.
As a response, as a really what is a natural response to trauma, which doesn't make any sense and is something that is, it's a cellular thing. It's not just a, you know.
It's not just a mental thing and getting over it and breathing through it. It is a, your body has gone through this trauma. Yes.
You've been biologically rewired.
Yes.
And a lot of people fear that those behaviours will be the things that are zoomed in on and what the perpetrator did will be
left behind.
Overlooked.
Yes.
When that is what should be focused on. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those maladaptive coping mechanisms are further evidence that something awful has happened.
Has happened to them, yes. How did you feel when that came out? Obviously, you had a worry about people that follow you, look up to you, feeling more shame.
Yeah, I think that there's many things can be true at once. I think that it's important not to glorify drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I've been open about taking drugs.
But this was also a leaked photo.
It was not. This is where I think it's quite funny. You know, the Daily Mail are hardly journalists.
Yes.
It was on my own Instagram. Like, good job.
Oh, yeah. So it was a photo that
someone
one day was like, I'm going to scroll to the bottom.
Yeah. Well, what happened was it was quite a coordinated campaign. I don't know if you.
Hit me.
I don't know if you recall this.
Oh, I remember.
There was a particular episode of 60 Minutes where somebody went on with his wife, who he frequently outsourced his morality to.
Oh, I can't remember.
And I was called rude.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Now, a lot of viewers of that particular program probably had no prior understanding of who I was, but went to my social media.
Oh.
And I remember getting a bucket load of hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And then 12 hours later, there was the bong photo to back it up.
Right. Okay.
Mm.
So someone's had a bit of time and scrolled down and found the bong photo.
Well, yeah, you know how the conservative dirt file machine works.
They can scroll. But so, okay, so it wasn't leaked. In my mind, it was leaked. Not really. It was already up there.
It was just a coordinated series of events designed specifically to discredit me.
And also to ride the wave of you being relevant and being spoken about by the Prime Minister.
Correct.
So that's a good time to get more clicks. This is the insidious nature of media and a click currency, is that they will deliberately wait to release stories. I've had this happen to me many times. They've gone, they threaten you. Do you get emails with threats?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
I know people know this, but you'll get emails that are like, we have this information on you.
Mm-hmm.
And can you please do a statement? And I never reply. I'm assuming you never reply
as
well.
Extortion is what that is.
It's extortion. And then you don't reply. And then you know, like, I know that if I announce I've got a new job or something, I know it's going to come the week after. I prepare for it, which is very fucking exhausting.
It's blackmail.
To have to constantly.
But that is their currency.
Imagine that being your job, a sad little weasel in a room going, I'm going to email this person with a little mild threat saying, we'd love a comment, smiley face, thanks so much. And you go, thanks so much, guys. All you're doing is using my name to get clicks because there is a moment in media and misrepresenting me.
Can I ask, like, how is it that you're an advocate and you're literally, like, speaking out about all these things? Like, what can somebody have against you? Like, I'm a bit confused because in my circles, you're like a hero. So I really, maybe I'm out of touch and I'm in my own bubble, but what...
Let's go back to the numbers. So if we focus a lot on victimization statistics... There was a study whose findings came out last year. It was led by the University of New South Wales on the prevalence of perpetration. So there was an anonymous survey that was conducted online. It's a broadly representative study. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest of its kind undertaken globally, the first of its kind in Australia. And it looked at offending behaviours and attitudes among Australian men. And it found that 1 in 10 men has offended against a child.
Whoa.
1 in 10?
1 in 10 Australian men has committed an offence against a child. Now, 2/3 of that is online, but that is a lot of offending.
That is still an offence, online or not.
What was really interesting is the portrait of this type of offender, which the university study painted, found that these men are 2 to 3 times more likely to be working with children. They're more likely to be older, male, Caucasian, socially supported, working a really high income job, well-educated.
What?
And this is self-reporting?
Yeah.
So it's most likely much higher than that.
Yes.
But minimum 1 in 10.
Yes.
So those kinds of people are the people that would be against you. Is this to answer Lem's question?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a large child sex offender base that do not like me. And also, this is my take on things. I don't have any way of measuring this, but I think that what could be frustrating to child sex offenders is that I am focused on deconstructing their behaviours.
Yes, and confronting them with their behaviours. I imagine it's
the
kind
grooming
of like
as opposed to just the incidents themselves, which are widely reported on. We hear about child sexual abuse in the media, not as often as it actually occurs, but we do hear about it often enough. These things are covered. But usually the focus is on the culmination of incidents, which make up a very small part of the entire grooming and offending synthesis. We're talking about cases that might go on for a period of years. Mm-hmm. And obviously you can't capture all of that in one article or even a series of articles.
Mm-hmm.
But what is not really focused on, which you could have time to cover in an article, is all of the precipitating behaviours, all of the techniques that an offender uses to groom.
Well, what are the techniques and the precipitating behaviours that are less known? I mean, I know as a big idea what grooming is, but I couldn't tell you specific instances, like examples.
There's a pair of American psychologists who co-authored a paper in 2016 about grooming. Their names are Elizabeth Jeglick and Georgia Winters. The grooming synthesis that was outlined by these two psychologists is essentially targeting a victim. As we know, all children are vulnerable, but often offenders will look for a child with added vulnerabilities, disability, social problems, other kinds of disadvantage, marginalization. And then there's the gaining trust, that creating a fictionalized friendship that the child will believe in. Then there's filling a need. So they'll often identify where a child has a gap in their social support network or another area of their life, and then they'll play a role that specifically fills that gap to create that bond with the child. Then there's the isolation, which speaks for itself, but offenders will often deliberately drive wedges between the child or children and their genuine support network, make it so that the child is entirely dependent on the offender for their self-worth, for their reinforcement, for their needs. The fifth element, or the fifth element, it's a great film. Fifth phase is the sexualization, which is happening throughout the process. And that's where the offender will gradually introduce sexual content to the child so as to normalize it. And that might actually include child sexual abuse material, but other material that is of a sexual nature, or even just, you know, slightly sexualized touch that then escalates over time in such a way that the child begins to expect it and has a neutral association with it. Again, it's normalized. And then by the time, you know, penetrative sex is initiated, if it gets to that stage or if it's molestation or something like that, the child doesn't actually know. They might be uncomfortable with the touch, but they can't detangle it.
It's
from
like a slow,
all of the other elements that have been carefully woven together by the offender. And then the sixth phase is maintaining control, which is striking that perfect balance between causing harm, but then also being the provider of relief from that harm. So the offender makes themselves at once the villain and the savior, the poison and the antidote. Essentially, the entire world revolves around the offender and the offender's needs.
and then the victim doesn't trust anyone around them because they've been isolated in
Correct.
That way to rely entirely on the perpetrator.
Correct.
So for any parents, how can one differentiate between a genuine mentor or someone that is genuinely trying to help a child and can see that they maybe are struggling in a certain way and something that is actually grooming and leading down that path?
That's where it gets quite tricky, and it is really hard to combat child sex offenders because by their very nature, they are often, not in all cases, but often offenders more broadly. They're often Machiavellian, psychopathic, and prepared to protect themselves at all costs. Mm-hmm. You know, they lie very comfortably. They're very manipulative. And so it can appear as though they do have good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's things like when an offender is discouraging a child from spending time with their parents.
Yes.
And you start to see that, that's a telltale sign. And you'll see, typically you'll see drastic behaviour changes in the child. They'll probably lose interest in the things that they traditionally like to do. But it can look different in every case. I guess that's
the whole thing, isn't it? Like you were saying, there's all this lead up to, quote unquote, the event of a perpetrator committing an act, but actually the act begins when they're grooming. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. And as the University of New South Wales study of perpetrator prevalence found, these offenders are often highly intelligent
mm-hmm.
and 10 steps ahead of the rest of the community. So they adapt their methods. Technology is one way that they have been able to remain undetected for so long, and it enables the offending itself. Grooming happens a lot online, mm-hmm. on the clear web, on platforms like Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. Offenders will impersonate children. They'll essentially catfish them. There's so many ways that technology has enabled child sex offenders.
And more children have access to social media accounts. How old are you? Are you? I feel like you're my age. Are you 29?
Yep.
28, so we're 95.
94. December 28.
So, all right. We're 6 months apart.
Really? But how old are you?
29 this year in June. So I'm 28, but I'm 95, June 95.
Right, I feel like you're older than me.
No. So I think I always think about things like Habbo Hotel and Club Penguin and those sort of, I guess, I think of them as kind of like danger zones of child sexual offenders. But they were sort of in corners of the internet when you and I were that age. But now children have access to multiple social media platforms from when they're like, what, 8 years old? Like, how old are kids when they're getting social media platforms?
If you look at the majority today, most children don't have a context outside of technology being present in their everyday
yes,
life.
So true.
See, I remember a time, you know, when I didn't have any access to the internet, didn't know what the internet was.
Yeah, going to the computer room.
Yeah, going dial-up internet to play Neopets.
Yeah, the dream. I mean, would love a bit of Neopets right now, to be honest. Neopets. We'd love a little bit of Neopets right now. As an intermission, we'll just play some Neopets for a while, go to the little rainbow, go to the little, what was that place called with the fucking treasure?
I have no idea.
Oh, neither. I can't remember at all. Don't even think about it.
I just like...
No, but yeah, you're right. There was we have context of life with and without the internet.
Yeah, but now it's... Now it's enmeshed, it's integrated mm-hmm. with our daily life.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that that allows much more opportunity for predators to infiltrate children.
So, for example, before you were asking me about how offenders trade secrets or trade craft.
Yes, yes.
So recently there was information found about this particular technique offenders were sharing with each other on the dark web, which it was to target single mothers on dating apps so that they could eventually solicit a photo of their children. That's an example.
Well, that was a thing that Dr. Phil spoke about a lot, not being funny. Remember Dr.
Phil? Dr. Phil.
Oh, I know, but he would always speak about, I remember this being vivid in my brain when I would watch Dr. Phil when I was a kid about, because I had a single mother and nothing ever, not saying this thing, but like he would say that it's like, I don't want to say the number because I can't remember it, but it was like something like 13 times more likely to be a step-parent or a stepfather, an unrelated man in the house than to be anyone else. So that strategy makes a lot of sense.
I think it's in 1 in 7 cases.
Yeah.
Of a relationship between a stepfather and a daughter is incestuous.
So they are trading these approaches.
That's just one example of a technique.
How can any of this even be remotely managed, whether it's by parent in the household or by... It feels like it's out of control, like a wildfire.
There are lots of ways to manage it, but there's a huge... responsibility for tech companies themselves to actually build guardrails into their programs. Mm-hmm. And they can do that. I find it personally quite frustrating. I think it was in May last year, a number of the heads of these big tech giants like Google's DeepMind and Meta and a number of other so-called godfathers of AI all came together and wrote this one sentence long letter, open letter. And it was essentially warning people of the capabilities of AI and comparing its detrimental effects to nuclear war and pandemics. Mm-hmm. Greenhouse effect didn't get a mention because obviously that would be too on the nose.
Yeah, no. Too political, babe, too political.
So what they wanted was a scapegoat.
Of someone to point the finger at. But actually government were involved.
They were already doing like illegal arms dealing, you know, fraud.
The government wouldn't do that, Grace. What are you talking about? Don't be, babe, calm down, okay?
It's the classic intelligence technique of accuse the enemy of doing exactly what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
Find a scapegoat. So make a smokescreen.
Predators have been using these encrypted messaging systems since the start of the internet. And that's now followed through to today. Obviously, all what's happening is technology is advancing. They're getting better at using said technology. There's less protections. There's more access for children and perpetrators. There's more opportunity. There's even, I want to know your thoughts on sharing photos of your children online, because there are certain TikTok accounts that are accused of playing up to perpetrators. I would tend to agree with that, but I wanted to know your thoughts because these videos are quote unquote innocent, but they are disturbing when you look at them through the lens of a perpetrator.
Yeah, and obviously not everyone has that context. That's not the prism that every person is looking through.
Yes, yes.
You know, I probably have more of a focus on it than the average person.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally have never used TikTok.
Oh, really?
Your brain
must be so fresh and not rotten. Oh, Grace, that's crazy. I want to have a look
in
there.
But I did smoke out of a 2-foot bong, Abby.
Nah, bad person. That's kind of, anyway, that is kind of cunty, the 2-foot.
And I just have to disclaim that I don't think it's right to glorify drugs, but I also don't think it's right to shame people who are working their way through whatever it is they need to work through. And a lot of people don't have access to healthcare, and so their methods are limited. Anyway, back to what we were talking about, TikTok. Again, I've personally never used it. And my views have certainly changed from my exposure to, or because of my exposure to this work. And there's information that I have now that I didn't have previously. I know that in the past I've shared photos of myself as a child. Mm-hmm. My mother has shared photos of my brother, who's going to be 14 next month. But when he was younger, she's done that on her own terms. And there's nothing necessarily, you know, that is innocent. But you've got to think about what child sex offenders could potentially do with that content, especially when generative AI systems are becoming publicly available. And there's a very low barrier to entry. It's just a textual prompt that you have to give the program, and really you're only limited by the speed of your computer. And you can keep editing until the picture or the content is to your liking. And as well, there was a study that was conducted by Stanford University that found that a lot of these publicly available AI tools, like ChatGPT even, have been trained on known child sexual abuse material. So they can actually be tricked into generating textual child sexual abuse material very easily.
So what do you mean by that? They've been trained on...
So all of those AI systems, all of those AI programs have to be fed a diet of text and content from which to create new content. It's not entirely new. It's pre-existing content that they're fed. And a lot of those publicly available tools, like I said, including ChatGPT, have been fed existing child sexual abuse material that contains real child victims.
Is that able to be
rectified?
Unquote, yes, and sorted through? You know what I mean? Is it or no? At this
point, it's very hard to walk backwards.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why there's a frustration knowing that these tech companies have known the capabilities of what they have been creating for decades. Mm-hmm. This isn't a new field. It's certainly not a new field of research. AI has been a field of research for over 50 years. It's very frustrating when now they all band together and come out and try to warn us about its potential.
When they knew.
Shock, horror. Uh-huh. Not only did they foresee it, they continued to develop it without doing anything about it. And there are many benefits that can come from AI technologies. If you look at its potential in the field of medicine, for example. But that's just not my wheelhouse.
Yes, but there are also huge, I mean, any technology development will be used for crime and for perpetrators, first and foremost, and to make money. It's like money, crime, and perpetrators, and sometimes those things interlap altogether. Often they do. So at this point, it's like, you know, it's already out there. We can't take it back. There is child sexual abuse material being generated by AI.
With the assistance of AI.
My question is, what the fuck, Grace Tame?
That's a great question. Yeah. And very eloquent.
Thank you.
Very defined specifics.
Yeah. There. I'm just wondering what the fuck is going on here and how it stops. And there also people would have arguments. Not me, before I fucking say this. But I want you to answer this question. People would have arguments that, well, it isn't real material, therefore it's not harmful.
Ah, that is the classic child sex offender script.
Yes, I love it.
If it is not an actual child, or if it's an image or a video, a representation, cartoonistic, textual, therefore it doesn't harm a child, which is false.
Okay.
For a number of reasons. First of all, to obtain child sexual abuse material, it has to involve a real child. There used to be obviously more of a production process involved in that, if we're talking about the difference between traditional child sexual abuse material and generative AI, which can enable the creation of new material. Mm-hmm. But it still has to come from somewhere. So like I said, those tools, those AI tools that can generate new imagery, new content, were trained on something. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, if we're talking about photographs of children or, you know, child sexual abuse material, it does. It contains a real victim. Mm-hmm. Then the added harm as well, because, you know, the existence of this content in of itself normalizes it. So if you're exposed to child sexual abuse material, and there's generally like a limit that people have. It's not necessarily a moral limit, but there's a physical limit to what people can do in real life. Mm-hmm. And they might have boundaries because of that. They might just not go
if
to a certain place
or because
it's just it's not feasible to perform certain acts on real people. Mm-hmm. Or they might not have ever dreamed it up before. But if they're exposed to it, and when we think about the fact that, you know, these child sex offenders that were surveyed as part of the UNSW's study of child sex offenders and their behaviours and attitudes, they're 25 times more likely to consume bestiality and violent pornography. Oh. So already you're talking about, you know, a distortion that goes beyond typical limits.
Yes, pushing those limits in multiple different arenas.
Yes. So just expanding exponentially this field of possibility. So then if someone views material that contains acts that they haven't actually considered, but then through viewing this material, they consider, well, obviously they go, not only do they go, well, that's a possibility, but they see it and they go, well, somebody else has done it. And then that it might actually encourage them to perform it. It's the same reason. So we're talking about age verification for access to pornography, yes, not just for the obvious reason, but because a lot of children will view pornography, or in fact, they'll view child sexual abuse material perhaps without realizing it, but that's how they learn to monetize their sexuality. They don't know the extent of the harm that that causes, or yes, or even if it's harmful at all, but that's a potential when children consume pornography.
Again, their brains are developing.
Yeah.
They're learning the rules of the world, quote, yes, unquote, and how they and what their social currency is, and also what their literal currency can be.
Yes, yeah, so there's this whole new level of commerciality to their sexuality.
And there actually aren't any restrictions really in terms of what, I mean, you can go on Twitter and watch anything you want. Well, sorry, X now, whatever the fuck. But it's very easy to access.
I do not miss that. There's no threshold anymore. And that's, yes, the problem with, you know, that is perhaps arguably the problem with the human intellect is that, and, you know, and now what technology has enabled that human intellect is just to constantly outdo,
mm-hmm, extreme
the previous
content,
example.
Yes, it goes further. Even if it's like a crazy dating story being told, there, it has to be, yeah, more extreme than
there
that.
There is no last frontier anymore.
Yes. Now it's endless. And now with AI, it truly is endless.
Can I ask, like, this whole time we're talking about the environment that we're in and obviously like the means that parents can navigate, but when we're talking about the predators themselves, if obviously it's like a journey that somebody can go on. And I'm just wondering, like, what does one do if they have these urges? Is there a place for them to go? And can there be some sort of a healing journey? And is this shame of calling somebody, you know, a pedophile without even looking at how we can rectify that behavior, preventing us from moving the conversation to a place where they can seek help and they can...
That's a really important point and a very crucial nuance in the discussion of child sexual offending that isn't often had. There are hotlines or services available for people who have sexual feelings towards children and are aware that they have sexual feelings towards children and do not want to act on those feelings. There are also services available like Partner Speak, for example, which is for the partners, loved ones, associates of who are non-offending, but they are connected in some way to a perpetrator. And those services are just as important when we're talking about early intervention and prevention as services for victim survivors and prevention education. Mm-hmm. When we think about the end goal being protecting children, if a service is there that could potentially stop a potential offender who might not have committed any criminal activity, if they can engage in help-seeking behaviours, that is a good thing. Mm-hmm. There is also a difference between a pedophile and a child sex offender, and the media would do well to learn this, mm-hmm, because a pedophile is somebody who has sexual feelings towards children. A child sex offender might not necessarily have sexual feelings towards children. They are offending for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, they might be people who consume violent pornography, engage in bestiality or consume bestiality pornography, but they're offending for other reasons besides sexual interest at all. It might be just entitlement. It's usually power. If that's the motivation, there's that sadistic element there. There's, because really child sexual abuse, prolonged child sexual abuse is a form of torture. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, in my own personal experience, I was offended against by a perpetrator who had offended before. He was a soldier before he was a teacher. He, you know, once told me a story about when he was in South Africa, he pretended to be mentally ill on a bus so that he didn't have to give up his seat for a pregnant woman. We're talking about a very high level of distortion, mm-hmm, with, and that's to not excuse the child sex offender because they're very aware of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they might not have sexual feelings towards children. They just get off on a power trip.
Yeah.
Is it, so that's why it's,
seeing our father
and,
they, can push
and they're
things.
less likely, even when they're caught, to want to engage in help-seeking behaviours because they do not believe they have done anything wrong and they want to continue doing it. But they'll lie
and say, I regret this.
Yes.
Because they want to have the power and control.
They're very good at impersonating pedophiles.
Right.
And they will they will lean into that ability to medicalize their behavior, even if they don't have a condition. Their pathology is more towards general criminality than it is towards a sexual orientation.
Right. So pedophilia is
Yeah, and it's actually not as common, I would say. Like, the majority of people who are convicted of child sexual abuse crimes are not actually pedophiles.
Really? So most of them are just, it's a power thing.
Yes, and a lot of them, a lot of them will have engaged in other criminal activity, like fraud, other things.
Okay.
Which reinforces, again, what the university found, which is that these people are very good at manipulating others for their own advantage.
And like you were saying, sociopaths and don't have empathy and are just using people
That's
around
correct.
Them.
But are very good at weaponizing them. They might not register empathy themselves, but they are very good at weaponizing the empathy of others in the community.
Okay, so is this right that there are pedophiles, if they act upon their feelings, they are then child sexual offenders, but most child sexual offenders aren't pedophiles because pedophilia is a condition, a mental condition that you have, and like you were saying, sometimes can elicit some kind of empathy, but it's actually about the act itself, being a child sexual offender, but pedophilia is about a feeling. It's just like a subset. It's like an umbrella term.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
And there are pedophiles who don't offend, who are quote unquote just pedophiles, or they have pedophilic tendencies or feelings.
Yeah, they have sexual feelings towards children.
But they are not necessarily child sexual offenders if they don't act upon it.
And the difference is that the insight into the potential harm that their behaviours can cause, whereas a lot of child sex offenders do not think that they have done anything wrong, and they do not think that having sexually engaging with a child will cause them any harm.
Cause a child any harm?
Yes. They don't believe that. That's the difference.
Whereas, what do they believe they're doing?
Whereas pedophiles often are aware that engaging sexually with a child will harm the child, and therefore they do go to lengths to engage in help-seeking behaviours. They might network, much like people who go to AA do, speak in environments where there's less stigma and shame. But child sex offenders typically, not always, but typically do not believe that they've done anything wrong. They don't have any insight into their behaviour. They might feign remorse, and they can be very, very good at it and convincing to elicit forgiveness, which really is just permission for them to keep offending.
Wow, yeah. Okay.
Big difference.
So
some overlap, but often a big difference.
Absolutely. So,
but the media relentlessly just use this blanket terminology of pedophilia. Mm-hmm. They'll even incorrectly, erroneously say pedo, which just means child, because pedophile comes from the Greek word love. Well, there's a number of reasons why the conflation of pedophilia and child sex offending is dangerous. One of them is, you know, while child sex offending should be criminalised, and especially when we're talking about, you know, your recidivist offender who is remorseless and the level of intensity of behaviour that they engage in and are prepared to engage in is torturous. My question to abolitionists specifically in that context would be, where are you going to put them,
mm-hmm.
if not in some kind of correctional facility?
Mm-hmm.
Not that there is a high chance that cohort are capable of being redeemed, if at all. But when we're talking about pedophiles who could potentially engage in help-seeking behaviours, but because of the shame that is proliferated about pedophilia, even if they haven't acted on it, and it's not necessarily about going, oh, I like these people and, oh, I feel sorry for them, but it's going, at least give them a chance to not offend. If they haven't offended, that's a good thing that they're engaging in help-seeking behaviours. Yeah. And we need funding for those supports.
Mm-hmm. But it's hard to get funding when there is the stigma, the extreme.
That's correct.
The conflation of those two titles. It's hard to get funding to give support to people who have pedophilic feelings, because then people will say that you are giving funding child sexual offenders.
And I can understand, as a victim survivor who in my early days of advocacy, we're talking over 7 years ago now, I had very different beliefs. I thought all child sex offenders were like the offender who abused me. I thought they were all that high level, really intelligent, torturous type of child sex offender. And so my, you know, the prism through which I was looking at this particular context was very discolored by that. But, you know, child sexual abuse also encompasses things like child on child offending, where there's children who are engaging in harmful sexual behaviors, some of whom, you know, are actually capable of committing quite violent crimes. I heard a case of a 14-year-old raping a 20-year-old woman. I think it was in broad daylight as well. And that's, you know, so even though they don't have the same neural capacity, they still have the physical capacity to cause grievous harm. Then you've also got children who are engaging in harmful sexual behaviours, and it's not that level of intensity of violence, but obviously, you know, it can still cause a lot of confusion and damage to, you know, the other child victims that they may be experimenting with. But also it may be the case that they have been sexualized by an adult offender and they need that support.
But, yes.
And instead they're getting chastised. So it's a really complicated space with lots of nuances. And it's why, as an individual, I truly believe in treating people on a case-by-case basis. You know, we can talk about these findings from studies which do, you know, point to patterns of behaviour and commonalities. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you've got to treat people on a case-by-case basis.
Absolutely. Otherwise, yeah, it is such a nuanced thing that also doesn't see much light.
No.
It's spoken about, if at all, with hushed tones and with words that dance around what's actually happening. So how are we supposed to have a national conversation about something that people can't even speak about, you know, one-on-one with people very comfortably at all? So, I mean, it's very jarring, like you were saying, a very jarring topic. And I guess it goes back to the start of our conversation about the media headlining things that you're doing in your personal life over your advocacy work, which is incredibly frustrating. I want to talk about you mentioned at the start of this conversation having autistic burnout. How do you minimize that, and what things are in place for you to prevent burning out?
It's really a process of trial and error, and it's dependent on several different moving parts, I suppose. My experience of autism, and I can only speak to my experience of autism, is that I'm very receptive to routine, and that's how I ground myself. I have like anchor points, whether it's an activity that I do repeatedly or a food that I consume repeatedly, just things that are safe that I can predict the outcome, or I'm familiar with the outcome of that thing, even if there are lots of other, you know, nebulous things around me.
Yes.
Whose, you know, outcomes I can't predict.
Yeah.
I can have things that I can turn to and rely upon.
What's an example of a meow?
Running.
Running, yes, because you're doing your running.
Yes, I'm doing my running thing.
I'm very jealous. Whenever I see you running, I go, oh, I should do that, and then I scroll. I go, Grace Tame's doing it. Maybe I should consider, and then the thought is gone by the time my fingers sit up, because I go, love that, Shook. Iconic, very impressive. But the running helps you prevent burnout.
Yeah, it's a way to regulate emotions. Any kind of exercise or movement naturally regulates the human body, and that doesn't just apply to autistic people or neurodivergent people. Or creative pursuits that get you out of the present moment and thinking about something else. You know, obviously different people enjoy doing different things. Different people for different reasons have access to certain outlets and not others. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy running because I love nature and I have a lot of energy.
Yes, and you can get it out and you can have a moment of...
And it is a way to release stored tension that would otherwise get stuck in your cells.
Mm-hmm.
So to move it naturally allows it to dissipate.
Yeah, it's like hot yoga. I always feel like I've like undone a knot after hot yoga. Yeah. And I need to do it now. I've gotten in like a routine of doing it. It's like the one thing that I go, I know I can breathe for this hour.
Yeah. So yeah, and I'm trained to teach two different styles of yoga.
Oh, what kinds?
Hot.
Hot and warm.
Yeah. Like
hot and hotter.
Hot and boiling.
But so when you're getting towards an autistic burnout, what does that look like for you? Because I get a lot of DMs and people saying that they struggle with having burnout, whether they have ADHD or they have autistic burnout. So how does that present for you? And can you feel it coming on, or do you, what does it look like?
Well, it can look different depending on what has led up to that point. Like, mm-hmm. what are the different sources of the multidirectional pressure and how have they coalesced? Mm-hmm. And it's a common autistic trait to experience something called alexithymia, which is where emotion is felt as an indistinguishable thing and you can't necessarily tease apart what that specific emotion is, you know, whether it's frustration or anger or... You name it.
It's like a big blob, it's like a big mass.
Yeah, it's just a big coagulated shit. Feeling.
Yeah.
That often for me presents in irritability or frustration. I don't register until it's too late that it's not that I'm irritated or frustrated. It's that I'm irritated and frustrated at myself for not communicating what my needs are. I grew up suppressing a lot of my needs mm-hmm. to fit in, sometimes in a home setting, and then certainly in the context of being abused, you suppress your own needs because, like I said earlier, your happiness is dependent on the happiness of the offender, and those lessons become really deeply ingrained if the severity, the intensity is particularly high. I mean, this offender, for example, was prepared to leave me a 15-year-old girl on the side of the road at nighttime, legless, because he didn't succeed in penetrating me upon his first attempt. I had vaginismus, and even though he'd given me a significant amount of alcohol to the point where I was stumbling around and not able to walk in a straight line, he was frustrated and did not care about my safety. And what does that teach you? That teaches you I have to do whatever I can to make myself safe. Mm. I have to do whatever I can to please this person who is dictating the circumstances of my life.
Direct result is me being very unsafe.
So those sorts of deeply ingrained people-pleasing behaviours can be really hard to unwind. Mm. And so often I just cop a lot and put aside my own needs for space and time and relaxation, and then just will fall in a heap and I will shut down. It's odd. I'm known for public speaking, but I will experience the autistic burnout in the form of not speaking sometimes. And like I said, I'll call a service and I'll just tell them the way I know how at the time. I'll say something like, I'm autistic, I'm having a shutdown, can you please assist me? Because I think that's also important to not put that on a friend or family member. That's also not to shame anyone who would prefer to talk to a friend or member of their family and feel comfortable. But I think what I've learned is that actually it can be harder to talk to somebody who's emotionally connected to you because they take that on.
Yes, and you get more overwhelmed because you're feeling guilty for making them worried about you and how you're feeling, and then you feel like you're overwhelming them, and then it's a big endless spiral cycle. Mm-hmm. I get that.
Yeah, vicarious trauma as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you choose to call places like Lifeline.
Yeah, because sometimes you find with trauma doesn't make sense, and it's looking for an explanation to something that really doesn't have an explanation because... You know, why should there be an I really dislike the phrase that is thrown around a lot, and that's everything happens for a reason.
No, it fucking doesn't.
Child sexual abuse does not happen for a reason. Reason.
Yeah.
No, you don't have to get a lesson from that.
No, thank you.
You don't have to find a silver lining. Mm-mm. You can build yourself back from that. But if you struggle, that's not your fault. It was never your fault.
Mm. Well, it really dismisses victims in saying you just can't see the lesson to learn here. You know, it's very condescending. What the fuck is a lesson?
No,
sometimes things are just shit. I think it also can stunt healing and trauma to say, oh, well, look at the silver line. You know, well, at least you did this because of it. And you're so resilient, you're so strong. You shouldn't have to be so resilient and so strong.
It keeps people on a psychological treadmill careering towards an illusion of wellness.
A destination that doesn't exist.
Yep.
Of being completely healed after a severely traumatic event or multiple concurrent severely traumatic events. How do you decide what to speak about? That's my last question, because it's something that I really struggle with my therapist especially, is how to know what to speak about and what to not speak about. And we spoke about earlier, there are things people don't know that you've gone through or that I've gone through, that we've experienced, even just feelings you've had or specifics about instances. How do you determine what to speak about and what not to speak about? Because I find when I overstep it, when I don't think about things in full, it comes and bites me in the ass and then leads to burnout because I get overstimulated, because all it does is create more work and more trauma. And it sounds silly saying that your trauma is work, but I mean emotional work, but I also mean literal work. Like if you have an experience you want to speak about and no one knows about it, and you're going to do, you know, a talk about like the lifeline, like you call in lifeline, that then results in you having to deal with other people's opinions on that, but also in people in interviews having something else to speak about, and then you get more press attention.
Yeah. I mean, I always ask the question, does the purpose that I'm aiming for outweigh the potential cost? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's hard to gauge, especially when you haven't gone through with a certain thing and you don't know until afterwards. Mm. But there are ways, you know, and I've had to learn this on the fly, really, and I still have a lot to learn. I still make a lot of mistakes. But if I'm trying to share my own lived experience, which is really my own qualification, I do consume a lot of research, and that tends to be what I integrate with my own experience. I talk about my experience actually not a lot, especially not the depths of it. My experience, what is known of it in the media, is quite a small portion of what actually happened. It's also a very whitewashed version of what actually happened. And there are significant chunks of that experience that I am figuring out how, if, when I share them, because they implicate other people who were there at the time. That's the truth. And in certain contexts, I will share it. If I know that it's private, there's Chatham House rules. You know, if I'm talking to a cohort of legal experts, or if I'm talking to a cohort of mental health professionals, I may share a greater level of detail because they have an understanding. They're trauma specialized. They have an understanding, and I can trust that they won't use that content against me. Not that, I mean, if I shared it, I think that you'd be very unwise to use it against me. It's further evidence of the, you know, level of distortion of the offender. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be respectful of the other people that are involved, you know, because it's in some ways it's not just my story. Mm-hmm. It's the story of others who were there at the time. Mm-hmm. So there's that element as well. But also as an autistic person who, and this is my personal experience of autism, is that I, you know, my filters are different, but that's really what autism is. It is a different neurotype. And so the information going in as well as the information going out goes through a different filter. I don't seem to register the same level of discomfort or...
if it's jarring or shocking.
Exactly, or embarrassment.
Yes, which is also a trauma response in ways as well. Just blurting out traumatic, which is what I do a lot, just blurting things out because you then dissociate from yourself, as well as I think having ADHD, it's a combination.
You disassociate, but also unconsciously you're wanting to connect. You're wanting to reconnect a disrupted attachment or a broken attachment. Mm. You're wanting to connect, find a new source of connection, because that's really the point of life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is to connect and share it with others. And
that's so true, Grace. Time. I loved that. Then on T-shirt, the true meaning of life is connect and share with others. And you've connected and shared today.
So it's me wearing a Black Sabbath T-shirt. Also, I can just like hear, I can hear the voice of the Daily Mail reader watching this going, I bet she doesn't even know one Black Sabbath album. Well, Ozzy Osbourne was very violent. He bit the head of a bat.
Oh, was he in Black Sabbath?
Yeah.
See, they all take the fall for that. Me going, yeah, rock on. I love it. I've recently started listening to Led Zeppelin, so I'm feeling pretty cool and sexy.
Just getting on that train. Yeah.
Just if anyone wanted to talk about it. I don't know. If anyone wanted to connect with me about a bit of Led Zeppelin, that would be great.
Jimmy Page, one of the greatest guitarists of all time.
That's what I say. All the time, as of the last 4 days, I've been going, greatest, goat. Grace, thanks for this conversation. It was insightful, interesting. You're amazing. Thank you so much for your time and your energy.
A Listener Production.